This is a reading of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Child, Changing Consciousness and Waldorf Education. This is lecture 6, given in Dornach on April 20th, 1923. Consideration of the relationship of the growing child to its surroundings raises the questions of ethical and social education. It is these two issues we will consider today, even if only briefly, and sketchily because of shortness of time. Once again, the crux of the matter is knowing how to adapt oneself to the individuality of the growing child. At the same time, you will have to bear in mind that as a teacher and educator, you are part of the social setting, and that you bring the social environment and its ethical attitudes to the growing pupil personally. Again, pedagogical principles and methods must be formulated in such a way that they offer every chance of reaching the true nature of the child, which one has to learn to know in accordance with what has been briefly shown here in the last few days. As always, a great deal depends on how one brings one's content to the pupils in their various ages and stages. Now, there are three human virtues we need to consider here. On the one hand, with regard to the child's own development, and on the other, seen against the background of society in general. They are the three fundamental virtues. Firstly, all that can live in willing gratitude. Secondly, all that can live in the will to love. And thirdly, all that can live in the will to do one's duty. Fundamentally, these are the three principal human virtues, to a certain extent encompassing all other virtues. Generally speaking, people are far too little aware of what, in this context, I should like to call gratitude or thankfulness. And yet gratitude is a virtue which, if it is to play its proper part in the human soul, has to grow up with the child. It is something that has to flow into the human being already at the time when the growth forces working in the child in an inward direction are at their liveliest, and when they are at the peak of their shaping and molding activities. Gratitude is something that has to be developed out of the bodily religious relationship, which I have described as being the dominant feature in the child from birth to the loss of the milk teeth. Yet at the same time, it is also something that will develop quite spontaneously during this first period of life, provided the child is treated rightly. All that is flowing from its inner being with devotion and love toward what is coming from the periphery through the parents and or other educators, and all that finds outer expression in the child's imitation, will be imbued with a natural mood of gratitude. We only have to behave in ways worthy of the child's gratitude for it to flow toward us, especially so in the first period of life. And then this gratitude develops further by streaming into the forces of growth which make the limbs grow and which even alter the chemical composition of the blood and other bodily fluid, in other body fluids. This gratitude lives in the physical body, and it must dwell in it, since otherwise it would not be anchored deeply enough. Now it would be quite wrong to constantly remind the child that it must be thankful for everything that comes from its surroundings. On the contrary, an atmosphere of gratitude should grow naturally, simply through the children's witnessing the gratitude felt by their elders as they receive what is freely given to them by their fellow human beings, and also in the way they express their gratitude. In this situation, one would also cultivate the habit of feeling grateful by letting the child imitate what is done in its surroundings. If a child will say thank you quite naturally, not in response to exhortations, but simply out of imitation, it does something that will be of great benefit for the whole of its life. For out of this, there will develop an all-embracing gratitude toward the whole world. It is the cultivation of this universal gratitude toward the world that is of paramount importance. It need not always be in one's consciousness, It may simply live in the background of one's feeling life, so that someone at the end of a strenuous day can experience thankfulness upon entering a beautiful meadow full of flowers, to give an example. Such a subconscious feeling of gratitude may rise up in us every time we look at nature. It may be felt every morning when the sun rises. It may emerge when beholding any of nature's phenomena. And if we only conduct ourselves rightly in front of the children, a correspondingly graduated feeling of thankfulness will develop in them for all that comes to them from the people living around them, from the way they speak, smile, or deal with them. This universal mood of gratitude is the basis of a truly religious attitude. For it is not always recognized that this universal sense of gratitude, provided it grips the whole human being during the first period of life, will engender yet something else. For in human life, love will flow into everything, if only the right conditions offer themselves for its development. The possibility of a more intensive experience of love reaching the physical level is given only during the second period of life, between the change of teeth and puberty. But that first tender love, so deeply embodied in the inner being of the child, without as yet working in an outward direction, this tender blossom will take firm roots through the development of gratitude. And love, born out of the experience of gratitude, during the first period of the child's life, this is the love of God. One ought to realize that just as one has to dig the roots of a plant into the soil in order, later on, to receive its blossom, so one has to plant gratitude into the soul of the child, because it is the root of the love of God. The love of God will develop out of universal gratitude as the blossom develops out of the root. We should pay attention to these things, because in the abstract we usually know quite well how they ought to be. Yet in actual life situations, all too often they turn out to be quite different. In theory, it is easy enough to state that people ought to carry the love of God within themselves, and this is as right as can be, but such demands made in the abstract have a peculiar habit of never seeing the light of day in practice. I would like to return to what I said during one of the last few days. It is easy enough to think of the function of a stove in the following way, quote, "You are a stove, and we have put you here because we want to heat the room. Your categorical imperative, the true categorical stove imperative, tells you that you are obliged to heat the room," close quote. We know only too well that this, in itself, will not make the slightest difference in the temperature of the room. But we can also save our sermonizing and instead simply light the stove and heat it with suitable logs. Then it will radiate its warmth without being reminded of its categorical imperative. And this is how it is when, during the various stages of childhood, we bring to the child the right thing at the right time. If during its first period of life we create an atmosphere of gratitude around the child, and if we carry out something else of which I shall speak later, then out of this gratitude toward the world, toward the entire universe, and also out of an inner thankfulness for being in this world at all, which is something that should ensoul all people, there will grow the most deep-seated and warmest piety. Not the kind that dwells on one's lips or in one's thoughts only, but a piety that will pervade the entire human being, and that will be upright, honest, and true. As for gratitude, it has to grow. But this can happen, with the intensity necessary for such a soul and spiritual quality, only if it develops from the child's tender life stirrings during the time from birth to its change of teeth. And then this gratitude will become the root of the love of God. It is the foundation of the love of God. Knowing all this will make us realize that when we receive children into Class 1, we must also take into consideration what kind of lives they have led prior to reaching school age. There really ought to be a direct contact with the parental home, that is, with what has gone on before the child entered school. This contact should always be striven for, because the teachers ought to have a fairly clear picture of how the child's present situation was influenced by the social conditions in the milieu in which it grew up. Then at school they will find plenty of opportunities of rectifying any possible hindrances. But for this to happen, knowledge of the child's home background through contact with the parents is of course absolutely essential. It is necessary for teachers to be able to observe how certain characteristics have developed in a child simply by watching and imitating mother at home. To be aware of this is very important when the child begins its schooling. It is just as much part of teaching as what is done in the classroom. These matters must not be overlooked if one wants to build up an effective and properly founded education. We've already seen that during the years between the child's change of teeth and the coming of puberty, the development of a sense for the authority of the teacher is both natural and essential. Out of it, there then grows the second fundamental virtue, which is love. At that time of life, the child is in the process of also developing the physical basis of love, but one has to see love in its true light. For, owing to the prevailing materialistic attitudes of our time, the concept of love has become very one-sided and narrow. And since a materialistic outlook tends to see love only in terms of sexual love, it generally traces all manifestations of love back to a hidden sexuality. In an instance of what I called dilettantism squared the day before yesterday, we find, if not in every case, that at least many psychologists trace human traits back to sexual origins, even if they have nothing to do with sex whatsoever. To balance such an attitude, the teacher must have acquired at least some measure of appreciation for the universal nature of love. For it is not only sexual love that begins to develop between the child's second dentition and puberty, but love in its fullest sense, love for everything in the world. Sexual love is only one aspect of love that develops at this time of life. At that age, one can witness how love of nature and also love of one's fellow human beings awakens in the child. And the teacher needs to have a strong conception of how sexual love represents only one facet, one single chapter in life's book of love. If one realizes this, one will also know how to assign to sexual love its proper place in life. Today, for many people who look at life with theoretical eyes, sexual love has become a kind of Moloch, devouring his own offspring, in that if their views were true, sexual love would devour all other forms of love. Love develops in the human soul in a way different from that of gratitude. Gratitude has to grow with the growing human being, and this is the reason why it has to be planted at the time when the child's growing forces are at their strongest. Love, on the other hand, has to awaken. The development of love actually does resemble the process of waking, and like it, it has to remain more in the region of the soul. The gradual coming into being of love is a slow awakening until the final stage of this process has been reached. Observe for a moment what happens when one wakes up in the morning. At first there is a dim awareness of vague notions, perhaps first sensations begin to stir. Slowly the eyelids rest themselves free from the closed position. Gradually the outer world comes to the aid of one's awakening. And finally the moment of waking passes over into the physical body. This is also how it is with the awakening of love, except that in the child this process takes some 7 years. At first, love begins to stir when sympathy is aroused for all that is being taught during the early days of school, at school. If we begin to approach the child with the kind of imagery I have described, we can see how love especially comes to meet this activity. Everything has to be saturated with this love. At that stage, love has a profoundly soul-like and tender quality. if one compares it with the daily process of waking up, one would still be deeply asleep, or at least in a state of sleeping dreaming. Here I am referring to the child's condition, of course. The teacher must not be in a dream, although this seems to happen all too frequently. This condition then yields to a stronger jolt into wakefulness. And in what I described yesterday and the day before, regarding the 9th and 10th year, and especially in the time leading up to the 12th year, love of nature awakens in the child. Only then do we see it truly emerging. Before this stage, the child's relationship to nature is totally different. It then has a great love for all that belongs to the fairy world of nature, a love that has to be nourished by a creative and pictorial approach. Love for the realities in nature awakens only afterward. And at this point we are faced with a particularly difficult task. Into all that belongs to the curriculum at this time of life, causality, the study of lifeless matter, an understanding of historical interconnections, the beginnings of physics and chemistry, into all this the teacher has to introduce, and here I am not joking, but speaking in deep earnest, the teacher has to introduce an element of grace. In geometry or physics lessons, for example, there is every need for the teacher to allow real grace to enter into the teaching. All lessons should be pervaded with an air of graciousness, and above all, the subjects must never be allowed to become sour. So often, just during the ages from 11 1/2 or 11 3/4 to 14 or 15, work in these subjects suffers so much by becoming unpalatable and sour. What the pupils have to learn about the refraction and reflection of light, or about the measurement of surface areas in a spherical calotte, calotte, is so often spoken of not with grace, but with an air of sourness. Just at this time of life, the teacher has to be mindful of the need for a certain soul breathing in the lessons, which communicates itself to the pupils in a very strange way. Soul breathing must be possible. Ordinary breathing consists of inhaling and exhaling. In most cases, or at least on many occasions, teachers in their physics and geometry lessons only breathe out with their souls. They do not breathe in, and it is the outgoing breath that produces this acidity. I am referring to the kind of outbreathing of soul that expresses itself in dull and monotonous descriptions, infusing all content with an added seriousness of inflated proportions. Seriousness does have its place, but not in an exaggerated form. On the other hand, an inbreathing of soul brings with it an inherent sense of humor that is always ready to sparkle, both inside and outside the classroom, or whenever there is an opportunity for teachers and pupils to be together. The only possible hindrance to such radiating humor could be the teachers themselves. The children certainly would not stand in its way, neither would the various subjects, provided they were handled with the right touch during this particular age. If teachers could feel so at home in their subjects that they were entirely free from having to chew over their content while giving lessons, then they might find themselves in a position where even reflected light was liable to crack a joke, or where the spherical calotte might calculate its surface area with a winning smile. Of course, jokes should not be planned beforehand, nor should they be forced upon the classroom situation. Everything should be tinged with spontaneous humor, which is inherent in the content, and not artificially grafted onto it. This is the crux of the matter. Humor has to be found in the things themselves, and above all, it should not even be necessary to look for it. At best, teachers who have prepared their lessons properly need to bring a certain order and discipline into the ideas which will come to them while teaching, for this is what happens if one is well prepared. But the opposite is equally possible. If one has not prepared the lessons adequately, one will feel deprived of ideas, because one still has to wrestle with the lesson content. This spoils a healthy outbreathing of soul and shuts out the humor-filled air it needs. These are the important points one has to bear in mind at this particular age. If teaching thus follows its proper course, the awakening of love will happen in such a way that the pupil's soul and spirit are rightly integrated into the human organization when the final stage of this awakening, namely the approach of puberty, begins. For this is the time when what first developed in the child's soul in such a tender and subsequently in a more robust way is finally able to grip the bodily nature in the right and proper manner. Now you may be wondering what the teachers have to do in order to be capable of carrying out their tasks in the way described. And here we have to consider something I would like to call the social aspect of the teaching profession, the importance of which is far too little recognized. Too often we come across an image of a certain age. Too often we come across an image a certain age, not however ancient times, has associated with the teaching profession, whose members are not generally respected and honored as they should be. Only if society looks upon teachers with a due respect for their calling, only if it recognizes that the teachers stand in the forefront of bringing new impulses into our civilization, and this not only when speeches are made from a political platform, only then will teachers receive the moral support they need for their work. Such an attitude, or perhaps better still, such a sentiment, would pave the way toward the acquisition of a wider and more comprehensive view of life. For this is what the teachers need. They, too, need to be fully integrated into life. They need not only proper qualifications in educational principles and methods, not only a specialist training for their various subjects, but above all they need something that will renew itself ever and again, namely a conception of life that pulsates livingly through their souls. What they need is a deep understanding of life itself. They need far more than what can pass from their lips as they stand in front of their classes. All this has to flow into the making of a teacher. Strictly speaking, the question of education should be part of the social question, and it needs to embrace not only the actual teaching schools, but also the inner development of the teaching faculty. At the same time, it should be understood that the aims and aspirations for contemporary education, as presented here, are by no means rebellious or revolutionary. To believe so would be a great misunderstanding. What is advocated here can be introduced into the present situation without any need for radical changes, and yet one feels tempted to add that it is just this social aspect of education that points to so many topical questions in life. And so I would like to mention something, not because I wish to agitate against present conditions, but only in order to illustrate or to put into words what is bound to come one day. It will not happen in our present age. Therefore, kindly do not look upon what I am going to say as anything radical or revolutionary. As you know, it is customary today to confer a doctorate on personalities who, fundamentally speaking, have not yet gained any practical experience in the subjects for which they are given their degree, be this chemistry, geography, or geology. And yet, the proof of their knowledge and efficacy surely would have to include the ability of passing on their expertise to other candidates, of teaching them. And so a doctor's degree should not really be granted until a candidate has passed the practical test of teaching and training others who wish to take up the same vocation. You can see great wisdom, based on instinctive knowledge, in the popular expression. For, in the vernacular, only a person capable of healing, capable of giving tangible proof of healing abilities, is called a doctor. In this instance, the word doctor refers to someone engaged in practical healing, and not just to a person who has acquired specialist medical knowledge, however comprehensive this might be. Gradually, two concepts have arisen out of the original single one, the concept of educating, as well as that of healing. In more distant times, teaching or educating was also thought of as including healing. The process of educating was considered synonymous with that of healing. because it was felt that the human being bore too many marks of physical heredity. Education was viewed as a form of healing, as I have already mentioned during a previous meeting here. Using the terminology of past ages, one could even say teaching was considered a means of healing the effects of original sin. Seen in this light, the processes of healing, set in motion by the doctor, are fundamentally the same as those of teaching, though in a different realm of life. From a broader perspective, the teacher is as much of a healer as a doctor, and so the weight the title doctor usually carries in the eyes of the public could well become dependent on a general awareness that only those who have passed the test of practical experience should receive the honor of the degree. Otherwise, this title would remain only a label. However, as already said, this must not be mistaken as a demand made by an agitator for the immediate present. I would not even have mentioned it, except in a pedagogical context. I am only too aware of what kind of claims are likely to be heeded in our times, and which ones inevitably leave the impression that one is trying to crash through closed doors. If one wants to achieve something in life, one must be willing to forego abstract aims or remote ideals, the attempted realization of which would either break one's neck or bruise one's forehead. One must always try to remain in touch with reality. Then one is also justified in using something to illustrate certain needs of our present age, even if these may be fulfilled only in the future. For what I have spoken of cannot be demanded for a long, long time to come. Nevertheless, it may help us to appreciate the dignity within the social sphere that should be the due of the teaching profession. I have mentioned all this because it seemed important that we should see this question in its proper light. If teachers can feel moral support coming from society as a whole, the gradual awakening of love in the young will become the close ally of their natural sense of authority, which must prevail in schools. These things sometimes have their origin in quite unexpected places. Just as the love of God is rooted in gratitude, so genuine moral impulses have their origin in love, as already described. For nothing else can be the basis of the truly ethical virtue except the kind of love for humankind that does not let us pass our fellow human beings without bothering to know them, because we no longer have an eye for what lives in them, as happens so easily in our present times. It is the general love toward all people, love that reaches out for human understanding everywhere. It is the love that awakens in the child during the time between the change of teeth and puberty, just as gratitude has grown between the child's birth and the loss of the milk teeth. At school, we must do everything we can to awaken it. How is the child affected by what is going on in its immediate surroundings during its first period of life, that is, from birth to the change of teeth? It sees that people are engaged in all kinds of activities, but what the child takes in are not the actual deeds in themselves, for it has not yet developed the faculty of consciously perceiving them. What it does perceive are meaningful gestures. During this first period of life, we have to do only with a childlike understanding of meaningful gestures it imitates. And out of the perception of these meaningful gestures develops the feeling of gratitude from which springs the gratitude-engendered will to act. Nor does the child perceive the activities going on in its environment during the subsequent years, between the change of teeth and puberty, especially not during the early stages of this period. What it perceives, even in the kind of movements performed by the people around it, no longer represents the sum total of meaningful gestures, but it now begins to speak to the child. It becomes a meaningful language. Not only what is spoken in actual words, but also every physical movement and every activity speaks directly to the child during this particular time. Hence it makes all the difference whether a teacher writes on the blackboard "leaf" in very nice letters, or whether he or she writes the same word thus, "leaf" very sloppily written. Whether the teacher writes the figure 7 like this, sloppy, or like this, nice, whether it is written in an artistic, in a Philistine or even in a slovenly way. All this makes a great difference. It is the way in which these things affect the child's life that matters. Whether the word leaf, blat, is written in the first or second way is a meaningful language for the child. Whether the teacher enters the classroom in a dignified manner, or whether he or she tries to cut a fine figure, all this speaks directly to the child. Likewise, whether the teacher is always fully awake to the classroom situation, in the child's eye this will show itself in the way she or he handles various objects during the lessons, or whether during winter time it could even happen that the teacher absent-mindedly walks off with the blackboard towel around his or her neck, mistaking it for a scarf. All this speaks volumes to the child. It is not so much the outer actions that work upon the child, but what lives behind them, be they unpleasant and ugly or charming and pleasant. In this context, it is even possible that a certain personal habit of a teacher may generate a friendly atmosphere in the classroom, even if, in itself, it might appear quite ludicrous. For example, from my 13th to 18th year, I had a teacher, and I always considered him to be my best teacher, who never began a lesson without gently blowing his nose first. Had he ever started the lesson without doing so, we would have sorely missed it. I am not saying that he was at all conscious of the effect this was having on his pupils, but one really begins to wonder whether in such a case it would even be right to expect such a person to overcome an ingrained habit. But this is an altogether different matter. I have mentioned this episode only as an illustration. The point is that everything teachers do in front of children at this stage of life has a meaningful language for them. The actual words spoken by the teachers are only part of this language. There are many other unconscious factors lying in the depths of the feeling life, which also play their part. For instance, the child has an extraordinarily fine perception, which never reaches the sphere of consciousness, of whether a teacher makes up to one or another pupil during lessons, or whether she or he behaves in a natural and dignified way. All this is of immense importance to the child, and as already mentioned during our discussion, it makes a tremendous difference to the pupils whether teachers have prepared themselves well enough to give their lessons without having recourse to any printed or written notes. For without being aware of it, the child asks itself, "Why should I have to know what the teachers do not know? After all, I too am only human. They are supposed to be full-fledged grown-ups, and I am only a child. Why should I have to work so hard to learn what even they don't know?" This is the sort of thing that rankles deeply in the child's unconscious, something that cannot be rectified once it has become fixed there. It confirms that the sensitive yet natural relationship between teachers and pupils of this age can come about only if the teachers, forgive this rather pedantic remark, but it cannot be avoided in this situation, have their content completely at their fingertips. It must live in them well-greased, if I may use this expression, but not in its sense of bad and careless writing. I use it here in the sense of greasing wheels to make them run smoothly. Then teachers will feel in full command of the classroom situation, and they will conduct themselves accordingly. This in itself will ensure an atmosphere in which it would never occur to pupils to be impertinent. For that to happen among 10, 11, or 12-year-olds would really be one of the worst things possible. We must always be aware that whatever we say to our pupils, even if we are waxing humorous, should never induce them to give a saucy or insolent reply. An example of this is the following situation. A teacher might say to a pupil who suddenly got stuck because of a lack of effort and attention, "Here the ox stands held up by the mountain," and the pupil retorts, "Sir, I am not a mountain." This sort of thing must not be allowed to happen. If the teachers have prepared their lessons properly, a respectful attitude toward them will emerge as a matter of course, and if that is there, such an impertinent reply would be quite unthinkable. It may, of course, be of a milder and less undermining kind. I have mentioned it only to illustrate my point. Such impudent remarks would destroy not only the mood for work in the class, but they could easily infect other pupils, thus spoiling a whole class. Only when the transition from the second life period to the third takes place is the possibility given for, how shall I call them now in these modern times, for the young men and the young women to observe the activities going on around them. Previously, it was the meaningful gesture that was perceived, and later the meaningful language of the events around the child. Only now does the possibility exist for the adolescent to observe the activities performed by other people in the environment. I have also said that out of the perception of meaningful gestures and through the experience of gratitude, the love of God develops, and that through the meaningful language coming from the surroundings, love for all things human is developed as the foundation for the individual's sense of morality. If now the adolescent is enabled to observe other people's activities in the right way, love of work will develop. While gratitude must be allowed to grow and love must be awakened, what is to evolve now must make its appearance with the young person's full inner awareness. We must have enabled him or her to enter this new phase of development after puberty with full inner awareness, so that in a certain way the adolescent comes to find the self. Then love of work will develop. This love of work has to grow freely on the strength of what has already been attained. It is a love of work in general, and also love for what one is doing oneself. At the moment when an understanding for the activities of other people awakens, as a complementary image, a conscious attitude towards love of work, love of doing, must arise. In this way, during the intervening stages, the child's early play has become transmuted into the right conception of work, and this is what we must aim for in our society today. What part do teachers and educators have to play in all this? It is something that belongs to one of the most difficult things in their vocational lives. For the best thing they can do for the child during the first and second life period is to aid what will awaken out of its own accord with the advent of puberty. When, to their everlasting surprise, they witness time and again how the child's individuality is gradually emerging, they have to realize that they themselves have been only a tool. Without this attitude sparked off by this realization, one can hardly be a proper teacher. For in one's classes one is faced with the most varied types of individualities. It would never do to stand in one's classroom with the feeling that all one's pupils ought to become copies of oneself. Such a sentiment should never arise. And why not? Because it could well happen that if one is fortunate enough among one's pupils, there might be three or four budding geniuses, quite apart from the dull ones, about whom we will have to speak later. You surely will admit that it is not possible to select only geniuses for the teaching profession, and that it is bound to happen that teachers are not endowed with the genius that some of their pupils will display in later life. Yet teachers must be able to educate not only pupils of their own caliber, but also those who, with their exceptional brightness, will far outshine them. However, this the teachers will be able to do only if they get out of the habit of hoping to make their pupils into what they themselves are. If they can make a firm resolve to stand in the school as selflessly as possible, and to obliterate not only their own sympathies and antipathies, but also their personal ambitions, in order to dedicate themselves to all that comes from the pupils, then they will rightly educate potential geniuses as well as dull-witted pupils. Only such an attitude will lead to the realization that all education, fundamentally, is a matter of self-education. Basically, there is no education other than self-education, whatever the level may be. In its full depth, this is recognized in anthroposophy, which, through spiritual investigation, has conscious knowledge of repeated earth lives. Every education is self-education, and as teachers we can only provide the environment for the child's own self-education. We have to provide the most favorable conditions in which, through our agency, the child can educate itself in accordance with its own destiny. This is the attitude the teacher should have toward the child, and it can be developed only through an ever-growing awareness of this fact. For people in general, there may be many kinds of prayers. Over and above these, there is this special prayer for the teacher. Dear God, make that I, as far as my personal ambitions are concerned, quite obliterate myself. And, Christ, make true in me the Pauline word, not I, but the Christ in me. This prayer, addressed to God in general, and to Christ in particular, continues, that the Holy Spirit may hold sway in the teacher. This is the true Trinity. If one is able to live in these thoughts, while in close proximity to the pupils, then the hoped-for results of this education can at the same time also become a social deed. And here other matters too come into play, and I can only touch upon them. Just consider what, in the opinion of many people, would have to be done in order to improve today's social order. They expect better conditions through the implementation of external measures. You need only look at the dreadful experiments that are being carried out in Soviet Russia. There the happiness of all the world is sought through the inauguration of external programs. It is believed that improvements in the social sphere depend on the creation of institutions. And yet these are the least significant factors within social development. You can set up any institutions you like, be they monarchist or republican, democratic or socialist. The decisive factor will always be the kind of people who live and work under any of these systems. And for those who spread a socializing influence, the two things that matter are a loving devotion toward what they are doing and an understanding interest in what the others are doing. Think about what can flow from just these two attributes. Nothing less than that people can again work together in the social sphere. This will have to become a tradition over eons. As long as you work only externally, you will produce no tangible results. You have to bring out these two qualities from the depths of human nature. If you want to introduce changes by external means, even if these are set up with the best of intentions, you will find that people will not respond in the way expected, and conversely, their actions may elude your own understanding. Institutions are the outcome of individual endeavor. You can see this everywhere. They are brought into being by the very two qualities, which to a greater or lesser extent lived in the initiators, namely, loving devotion to what they were doing and an understanding interest in what the others were doing. If one looks at the social ferment in our times with open eyes, one will find that the most peculiar ideas have arisen, especially in the social sphere, simply because the present situation was not understood properly. Let me give you an example. Today the message of so-called Marxism regarding human labor and its relationship to social relationships is being drummed not just into thousands, but into millions of heads. And if you investigate what its author alleges to have discovered, something with which millions of people are being indoctrinated, so that they look upon it as their socialist gospel, to use as a means for political agitation, you will find that it all rests upon a fundamental error regarding the attitude towards social realities. Karl Marx wants to base the value of work done on the human energy spent while performing it. This leads to a complete absurdity. For from the point of view of energy output, it makes no difference whether someone cuts a certain quantity of firewood within a given time, or whether, if he can afford to avoid such a menial task, he spends his energy and time on treading down the pedals of a wheel specially designed to combat incipient obesity. According to Karl Marx's reckoning, there is no difference between the human energy expended on those two physical activities, but cutting firewood has its proper place within the social order. Treading the pedals of a slimming wheel, on the other hand, is of no social use, because it only provides a hygienic effect for the person doing it. And yet Karl Marx's yardstick for measuring the value of work consists of calculating the food consumption necessary for work to be done. This way of assessing the value of labor within the context of the national economy is simply absurd. Nevertheless, all kinds of calculations were made toward this end. But the importance of one factor was ignored, namely loving devotion toward what one is doing, and an understanding interest in what others are doing. What we must achieve when in the company of the young is that by our own conduct, a full consciousness of the social implications contained in those two sentences will enter the minds of the adolescents. To do so, we must realize what it means to stand by the child in such a way that we aid its own self-education. The end of Lecture 6.